Welcome to the Not Unreasonable Podcast. I'm your host, David Wright, an actuary and reinsurance broker. This is a show of interviews with people who have something to teach us about managing our businesses and ourselves. There's a lot to learn out there, folks, so let's get to work. This show is brought to you by Beach, where I work and have worked my entire career. We are a global reinsurance intermediary, and we pride ourselves on creative thinking, deep analysis, and client service. Those three qualities are actually intimately related because you can't spend the energy digging deep into a problem unless you really care about the client. We find that when you really do understand the problem, the solution becomes obvious, even if it seems a little bit unorthodox to the outside world at first. The nature of insurance is to take solutions we know and trust and try to force them onto the problems of the day. We just don't settle for that. You can see further at beachgp.com. If you're an actuary, you, like me, probably dread the professionalism continuing education requirement. I think that the best time to satisfy this is in podcast time, while on your commute, while walking your dog, while mowing your lawn, while doing the dishes. Head over to notunprofessional.com, where, for the price of a CAS webinar, you can get content dedicated to continuing education for actuaries, especially professionalism CE. That's notunprofessional.com. Thanks for listening, and thanks for supporting the Not Unreasonable Podcast. And just before we start, quick plug for notunreasonable.com, where you can get links and notes related to all podcast episodes, today's included. You should also sign up for the mailing list. Why? Because I'm going to start putting together short bits of content every week. I do a lot of research and put a lot of work into these podcasts, and not everything makes it in. So each week, I'm going to send you a note with something that I've observed or heard or read. You'll enjoy it. Sign up at notunreasonable.com/signup. Now on with the show. My guest today is Tyler Cowan, professor of economics at George Mason University, blogger at marginalrevolution.com, podcast host at Conversations with Tyler, and my words cannot convey how strongly I recommend his work. Tyler is the author of numerous books, the latest of which, and the subject of today's show, is Stubborn Attachments. This is a philosophical work where Tyler lays out his value system. Here's a quick quote from his blog. No punches are pulled. This is my account of what I strongly believe, and you should believe too, my bottom lines, so to speak. Before we start, though, I want to try and give listeners a little bit of insight into why I'm talking to Tyler, because honestly, I'm worried that I'm going to fail in what I'm trying to accomplish today. It might sound weird, but before reading this book, I've thought of Tyler as an emotional mentor and role model to me. Luckily, I think morality as being built on emotional foundations, so Tyler's book actually gives us a pretty good framework for exploring what I mean by that. The goal today is to do no less than figure out what Tyler is and why. Big project. So let's see how we do. Tyler, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on. Thank you for the kind words.
I want to start with what I see as the most marginally important Cowanian contribution. And for the sake of the audience, marginal in this case doesn't mean small. It means that there are lots of commentators and public intellectuals out there saying, for the most part, a lot of the same stuff. But given all the very smart people saying very smart things, where does Tyler stand out? What do you need to go to Tyler for? My answer is that it isn't even Tyler, it's Tyrone. So I'll defend that selection in a minute, but maybe first, Tyler, if you could explain to us who Tyrone is, and I don't mean the name on his driver's license, but you can tell us that too. Who is Tyrone really?
Tyrone is a guest writer on the Marginal Revolution blog, and he appears periodically and writes very controversial or provocative ideas in a very straightforward, no-holds-barred tone. So the reason there is a Tyrone, I thought some while ago, well, there's thinkers out there, you'd like to read variants on them. Like, wouldn't you like to read a pessimistic Steven Pinker or maybe a right-wing Paul Krugman? You wouldn't necessarily agree with these variants, mm-hmm. but you'd want to see what would come out of the talent mixed with some different set of views, different approach. So what I did was I got on a plane and I flew to South Korea. And just as that woman had her dogs cloned in South Korea, I thought I would have myself cloned. And I had myself cloned in South Korea and then brought back the clone. But I figured most people wouldn't believe this. So I described Tyrone as, you know, my brother. In fact, when I was born, my father wanted to name me Tyrone. My mother wouldn't let him. And it became Tyler. He liked Tyrone Power, the movie star. So now there's this persona, Tyrone, who's a clone of me. But, you know, the cloning process a lot doesn't carry through. So you get like a variant on Tyler. And it's a way of having multiple Tyler voices that maybe is interesting or provocative. But Tyler himself doesn't have to, you know, bear all the hassles of being Tyrone.
Mm. So what I think about, the reason I think Tyrone is important is that it seems to me that you're able to, through that persona, embody a couple of different points of view, the gap of which we do not see many people cross, right?
Right.
And so that being, you know, there's a strong kind of almost anti-intellectual sort of bent about Tyrone. I'm not sure the right way of putting it. But he has a perspective on the world's problems that is wrong in a certain kind of way. And you're often quick to point out, Tyrone is so wrong about all these things. And then there you go, publish it on your blog under your own name is the author that goes in the publisher line or the writer line. And so I think of it as embodying a kind of conflict within yourself. There's a dialogue that goes on that generates the Tyler Cowen view at the end. But Tyrone's part of that. Is Tyrone, like, is that a representation of what you are? Is it a version of you, or is it something that is like a spoiler that you like to just sort of play off of? Do you believe what Tyrone says in any way?
Tyrone likes to bang on the table. Tyler doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
If you think, what's the best way to learn different arguments or points of view or avoid getting trapped? It's to take points of view you may not agree with and simply, you know, write them out.
Yeah.
I think it's the single best thing you can do, whether or not you blog. So in the course of doing this, sometimes you may decide, like, hey, I actually agree with this, but it will be a diverse set of responses. Sometimes you move away from it. You write it out. It's like, oh, my goodness, now I see what this implies. That really must be wrong. So engaging with Tyrone, I would say it pushes Tyler's views in all kinds of different directions.
Mm.
So it's not that, oh, Tyler really agrees with Tyrone, or Tyrone is the opposite of Tyler. You could say Tyrone increases the variance of Tyler in many different directions
and
keeps him open-minded.
I like that phrasing. Now, I'm going to go a bit deeper on Tyrone still. I'm not done with him yet.
Nor is he done with you.
I think not. So I learned that you're from Bergen County.
New Jersey, correct. Northern Jersey.
That's right, during our correspondence. And I live right now, I'm from Canada originally, but I live in a town called Ridgewood, New Jersey, which is a few towns over from the town you grew up in. What interests me about that particular area where you grew up, it's a little bit country. And so it's a suburban area of New York, but it's not manicured gardens. It's a little hilly, there's a little rocky, there's a lower socioeconomic level there than you'd think, being that close to New York City. And when you grew up there, it must have been very much more like that, I would think, for, you know, 30, 40 years ago. Am I right on that being an important kind of feature of that part of the country? Does that, because I think of actually Tyrone's view as being, I know Tyrone's. I grew up in a small town myself.
Sure.
And I know people who are really smart, smarter than you think they should be in some ways.
Yes.
And who are giving opinions about things that are irritatingly difficult to push back on because they are kind of right. And it's hard to actually defend, call it a more sophisticated view, which might be more correct, but in a way to meet them on their own terms and actually beat them on their own terms. And I think it's a very frustrating intellectual process. And so what my kind of like working hypothesis on Tyrone, there might be a real person that you're modeling Tyrone after. Could that be somebody that you grew up with or met or knew when you were a child or a young adult?
Well, a composite weight. Think of my background this way. I was born into Hudson County, which at the time was completely working class.
Yep.
As my father was upwardly mobile, we moved into the wealthier Bergen County. But my town, Hillsdale, was still part like Irish-American working class, Italian-American working class, and Jewish, which tended to be more intellectual.
Mm-hmm.
So I had those diverse influences and then this quite working class background. My father hadn't gone to college.
Right.
And I too grew up with many Tyrones. Or if I hear Donald Trump speak, it sounds very familiar to me. It's not strange or disorienting. It's like, oh, you know, I heard that 40, 50 years ago.
One of these guys made it.
Correct.
Yeah.
And Tyrone is somewhat of a throwback to that time and place. So I like to say all thinkers are regional thinkers.
Yes.
Tyrone himself is indeed a regional thinker.
Right. And his region is working class northern New Jersey.
I would say Tyrone's region is a bit to the south of Tyler's region.
Okay.
Tyler's region is Bergen County. Intellectual, not too far from New York City, New Jersey. Tyrone's region is much more Hudson County, closer to the heartland, Sopranos territory, Bruce Springsteen land.
Mm. You know, so where I think Tyrone, the way that I think that he gets integrated into worldview, I think of that as being really, instructive as a way to diversify your own thought process, I guess. And there's another thread in a lot of your thinking. To the point I made earlier about the word I'm using was emotional mentor. And although this is the first time we've met, so you don't know me or know, you know, kind of what kind of person I am, but I like your attitude and the openness you have to these different kinds of view and actually accepting them on their own terms and saying, you know, there's something here. This isn't just you being less educated than me, or speaking with different jargon, or wrong is just wrong, and I can now dismiss everything you say. There are good parts there, and I think that there's an openness. And the word you use in your book, which we'll touch on now maybe a little bit, is pluralism, which I think is evidence of this phenomenon in your own personality. Maybe you can tell me what you think of that assessment, and maybe define what pluralism is and how it works in stubborn attachments.
Well, first, maybe Tyrone needs a sister, but since I plan to keep on writing the blog, there'll be time for that. But pluralism I take to be the view that everything is not just what utilitarianism suggests. Human well-being is very important, but other values matter. There are human rights. The arts can have an independent value above and beyond how much people are willing to pay for them. There's such a thing as beauty, as justice, and our assessment of a good society, it's a kind of weighted average of many different things. So we always need to be viewing a question from multiple perspectives.
Mm-hmm. And valuing those perspectives, even if, well, I suppose maybe overvaluing them in some sense, because deliberately. So you might not agree with somebody's view, but you recognize and respect that it has some value, even though you yourself don't assign any value to it.
And you ought to weight it with some probability. So
right.
Let's say you mostly think the arts don't have any value above and beyond what people are willing to pay for them. But it might be true with 5%.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in your calculations for a good society, you should put it in with, right, 5%.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to worry about many more things than you might actually think are true. That's this huge burden. People don't like it. They like to push that stuff away, keep things neat and easy to deal with. What I call the philosophy of once and for allism.
Mm-hmm.
They want to be done with stuff once and for all, but
yeah.
That rarely works.
Yeah.
But it's always tempting.
And one of the things another idea I associate with you is actually being pretty okay with the messiness of the world in some ways.
Or celebrating it, that's right.
Right. And that's related. I mean, surely that's related. So there's some link there between being able to acknowledge that other people's perspectives are, you know, there is a Tyrone inside of you, and there are people who have views that you don't agree with, but still value with some probability, and it's a mess. And that's okay.
Absolutely.
So in the book, I think that there's a where that manifests itself is in this idea of, I think, and maybe I'm getting this, I may draw on this link properly, between radical uncertainty. Maybe you can define for us what radical uncertainty is and how that works in your kind of philosophical view or your framework.
Any action you take now to bring about a better state of affairs in the world is subject to extreme uncertainty.
Yeah.
It will have many long-run ramifications you can't forecast. Partly just policy science or policy analysis is imperfect. If it's foreign policy, our ways of modeling those decisions, they're really not very good, right?
Mm-hmm.
We don't have systematic data and easy models to measure. And then there's the deeper philosophical point that even small changes, they will influence which people meet each other, which people marry, the timings of their conceptions. So they remix the future identities of everyone in the world. So the general point is, even if you're doing something that you think in expected value terms is the best thing to do, the chance you will be pretty wrong is likely fairly high. So you may, you know, favor what you're doing like 52 to 48 or 53 to 47. But rarely is it like 99 to 1 or 98 to 2.
Mm.
So for most reasonable disagreements with like non-totally evil people, the chance you might be wrong is really pretty high, even if your arguments to you seem much better and you don't see why the other people don't get them.
That's related to pluralism, is it?
Absolutely. So
yeah.
That pluralism and this epistemic uncertainty, they're really two sides of the same coin.
Yeah. And so there's a twin idea in the book. And we're going to keep getting into the book.
Sure.
But there's a
but
twin
this
idea.
This is the book.
Yeah, that's twin idea in the book, which is about rights, right?
Correct.
And so that there are actually still absolutes.
That's right. So there are some activities we should not do, even if it will bring great gain to civilization.
Mm.
So killing and torturing large numbers of innocent people would be an obvious example. It's not the main topic my book is about. I simply want to point there are constraints on the calculus of utilitarianism.
Right. And that, I think of those two ideas. So this idea of, call it relativism, maybe. I mean, I don't know, you can push back against my use of that word. And rights as being in conflict, being in tension, always inside of you and inside of other people. Did you always have both, or did you sort of like start out as a bit more of a pluralist and you've kind of, you know, drifted towards a bit more of a, I'm not sure about the, whatever the opposite of pluralist is over time?
I started more as a rights theorist.
Okay.
But the space of decision-making open for utilitarianism has gone up in my mind with age. But I would say this, here's the surprising thing I learned writing the book. a meaningful notion of rights has to be pretty close to absolute. Because if your rights are weak, wishy-washy rights, I mean, over a long enough period of time, the well-being from the utilitarian calculus will overwhelm those rights. So rights are either not very important or they're strong and absolute. Yeah. And I hadn't really understood that until I tried to write down this book.
Yeah, interesting. And did you have the, what parts of this book existed in Tyler Cowen, age 16?
Probably a lot of it. And this is an unusual book. I've been working on it for 20 years, but not the whole time. So like every year I would take a month or two and just try to improve this book.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, my views on these topics will change. This book needs 20 years, but it's too short a book to have just worked on it straight through for 20 years. So some of the 20 years I just spent taking out parts of the book.
Okay.
And I had a lot in an earlier draft on existential risk, which I still agree with, but enough other people published on that topic. You know, I narrowed down this book and it took me a year and a half just to basically, you know, do control C and delete.
Yeah. Yeah. But in terms of the younger Tyler, I mean, so you mentioned that you're a bit more of a rights theorist. Was that like really early, like pre-college, high school Tyler?
Like 14-year-old Tyler.
Was a rights guy.
Was a rights guy. But back then, you know, I believed in capital.
Who influenced you in that?
Sorry?
Who influenced you in that to get you to that opinion, do you think? Was your dad a rights guy or your, you know, was something?
He was not very philosophical. You might say he had an inchoate view, similar to a rights view. But Ayn Rand I read when I was early. I was influenced by that. Libertarian thinkers, people like Milton Friedman, who was not himself a rights thinker. But you read Friedman, you start thinking in terms of rights, even though he claimed to be a utilitarian. Mm. But the real Milton Friedman, in fact, was also a rights thinker. Mm-hmm. So early exposure to a lot of libertarians, mostly. Rothbard.
What was the most important thing your father taught you?
To get up every day and work. And be responsible, and don't complain, and don't feel the world owes you a living.
Hmm. And do you think about that?
Oh, all the time, of course.
As part of his teaching to you, you think about your dad, and you think about that doing that every day.
I don't know about every day, but very often, some days more than once. And he didn't pay for my college, I should add, and that was very good for me. Like when I was an undergraduate, I started my own business, like writing and editing and doing things. I supported myself. And maybe now that sounds outrageous to people, like an upper middle class father wouldn't pay for his kid going through college. But it's one of the best things anyone ever did for me. Mm. And I'm very grateful that's how it was.
Mm. And how about your mom? What'd she teach you?
Kindness, compassion, openness, and tolerance. So my father was more dogmatic. My mother was very open, loved to read about Eastern religion. Jonathan Livingston Seagull was one of her favorite books. So a kind of...
Pluralist?
Pluralist, absolutely.
So rights versus pluralism in the Cowan household.
Correct.
Yeah. And did that, is that something that is, how true is that as a characterization of your upbringing? Was it, you know, are you actually just the synthesis of your parents' philosophical views, implicit though they might be?
Probably, sure.
Yeah. Here's another thought that I actually ask this to people in job interviews. So you'll be interviewing for a job now, Tyler. How does the relative strength of your, call it your intellectual capability, your personality, change over time? So you're in high school, you're probably a pretty good high school student, I would imagine. So, but you had a relative strength, say, against your peer group, and then in college did that change? And so, you know, now everybody's kind of smart now, so now I'm going to change, you know, now I'm going to adapt a little bit. And there's a feedback mechanism here, right? And then maybe as your graduate student, maybe as a professor, and over time it evolves, you know, kind of what your marginal contribution is. How would that have changed over your life?
In relative terms, I've become much worse at math relative to my peer groups with age.
Having started out pretty good, probably.
Right. And much better at the humanities and doing and integrating theory and practice and judging talent.
Yeah.
And I've worked hard at trying to better myself in those areas.
Right.
And haven't worked I've gained hard. A lot in those areas. And in terms of like how rapidly I can multiply two numbers in my head, both I've gotten worse at it, absolutely, and I keep on meeting people who are way, way better at it than I am, not to mention topology and differential equations.
And so is there a lesson there in kind of, is there a value statement that's embedded in that, right? Because you could have chosen to work more at math, but you've chosen instead to work more at these other things. Does that mean they're more valuable, those skills?
No, you always need to change what you're doing as you age. Because your peers are changing, what you're good at changes, and what the world demands changes. Mm-hmm. So if you're just doing the same thing, you get into a rut, you either tend to burn out or you become bored. And waking up every day and asking myself, what should I be doing next? How is it different? Mm-hmm. Is something I've tried to live, you know, from the beginning pretty much.
Mm-hmm. There's another thread to a lot of your writing and thinking that I share this with you, where there's an appreciation and respect for religion in some of what you write, or quite a lot of what you write.
I'm not religious myself.
Right. And likewise. And yet, but man, it does a lot of good for the world, for the most part.
Correct. Right? And even if some of it harms the world, you know, we should seek at the margin to move toward having more constructive religion and less destructive religion. It's one of the main forces that moves people.
Yeah.
And a lot of secular intellectuals, they might pay lip service to this, but it's not internalized as part of their worldview.
Mm-hmm. I think of religion, for those who choose to be critical of it, they see it as a set of constraints against people. And they say, you know, there's rules, you can't do this, you can't do that, and people find that confining. I think for outsiders, find that confining. But I think the experience of people within religion, some of you think of this, is that it's restraint, not constraint, right? So restraint is more about, I'm choosing to not do these things because I think it's good for me, whether I totally understand why it's good for me or not. Restraint is actually almost a liberating feeling as opposed to constraint, which is a confining feeling. What do you think about that distinction?
It's true. And religion can tie people together and give them opportunities the secular don't necessarily have.
Mm-hmm.
And they feel related. They would call it God, but whether or not you think it's God, to some notion of creation, the universe, in a way that may well be harder for secular people.
And do you don't drink, right?
Not at all. That's right.
Right. And so that's a restraint, right, that you're choosing to adopt in your life. What's interesting, so I have this experience when I was in high school. I sat through a class and these women came in from Alcoholics Anonymous. And they said to me, they said to the class anyway, they referred to themselves in the present tense as alcoholics. And they hadn't had a drink in whatever, 20, 30, whatever number of years, right? But it was a personality characteristic whereby they had to impose upon themselves this extraordinary restraint. They needed to because they had this problem of addiction. And so there's an interesting kind of point there about, I think, once you let something in, it can take over. And then you have to be more extreme in your desire, in your removal of it after the fact. And I'm wondering if you've ever felt you've been addicted to something before where you need to have extraordinary restraint. It could be work. It can be all kinds of things, right? It doesn't need to be something necessarily destructive, actually.
I think I'm addicted to work, but I've never accepted the restraint on that. I've been drunk twice. I used to drink red wine, you know, reasonably often, a few times a year, and I enjoyed it. I still think it's a very fine pleasure. But at some point, I just stopped, realized I don't miss it. I work enough. If I have, like, a meal out with people, I actually go back, and odds are I want to do some work. And if I've had some alcohol, I can't do that. And I think it's a positive for other people just to see you can live a life without alcohol. There was a study on my blog, Marginal Revolution, this morning, an estimate that 1 out of 20 deaths in the world result from alcohol.
Yeah.
It may be a mismeasurement, but that it's even plausibly the right number, to me, is stunning. And it's hardly ever discussed. The early 20th century notion that prohibition was like a major social issue has fallen off the table. I think we should think about it much, much more. I don't want to throw people in jail for drinking, but people, I think, should voluntarily abstain and become social examples that, you know, it's possible not to drink at all.
Yeah, and in language you'd use, raise the status of non-drinking.
Correct.
Yeah.
Mormons have done this as well. It's another way in which religion can be a big positive.
Yeah. I want to turn now back to the book and talk about there's another pair of ideas, which I think are really related. And I actually think of the first set of ideas there as sort of the moral core of Tyler. You know, these are the urges maybe you have and you're acting to a bit more emotionally, perhaps. And the next set of ideas I think of as actually being much more intellectual ideas. And these two ideas are time preference and economic growth.
Right.
And maybe you can talk about, you have some interesting thoughts. It's the first time I'd ever seen something like this on time preference. Maybe define what that is and then explain your view on it in the book.
Time preference is the preference that many people have to think what is coming up soon is significantly more important than what's going to happen later.
Mm-hmm.
And from the social point of view, I argue that time preference is not rational, that we should care just as much about the distant future. We should discount it if we're not sure something will happen, but we shouldn't discount it simply because it's more distant in time.
Mm-hmm.
So imagine that if in the days of antiquity, Cleopatra had taken an extra heaping of dessert and said, well, this may lead to 5,000 people dying a horrible death, you know, in the year 2000, but this is now, that's more important. When the year 2000 comes, it's just as real as the time of Cleopatra for the people in it.
Yeah.
There's not some kind of waiting in the meantime that anyone has done. So morally, we usually, at the social level, should think of time as an illusion and worry more about the future. And that has an interesting implication. that it turns out the best social policy will be the one that maximizes the rate of sustainable economic growth, because that will make the future much, much better.
And what I think is especially powerful about these, both of these ideas, I mean, powerful maybe not the right word there, but they're counterinstinctive, let's call it, right? So these are both two ideas which actually, so the particularly the idea of you know, no zero discount rate, that is value some an outcome in the future the same as you'd value it today. That is not something that humans naturally do. We prefer the bird in hand as opposed to two in the bush, although that's not an exact metaphorical mapping to what you're talking about.
Put off going to the dentist, right?
Right, right. So, you know, you'd rather have something today, it's more real, and you deal with some of those arguments, but it's not something that instinctively somebody would just come up with, probably.
You know, you're an actuary, so the notion of taking advantage of the power of compound returns must be quite familiar to you.
Of course.
What I'm saying is society should, in essence, be organized around this principle.
Yeah.
It's the strongest principle we have. And people in finance, insurance, people who are actuaries understand this. They live and work it every day. But it's not really a part of political philosophy. If you read the great political philosophers, it is mostly absent from mm-hmm. their thought. Mm-hmm. And what I'm trying to do is bring the idea of compound returns into philosophy. I might add, also into education, that the way to train yourself to be smarter is to be along learning curves that have compound returns and not just one-off learning.
Yeah, yeah. And again, something that I think the idea of compounding is something we struggle with intuitively. It's something you have to learn.
It's That's right.
Yeah, you have to deliberately learn. Observe in the data in order to convince yourself that it's true, probably.
And people will borrow money at crazy rates of interest. They think of it as a one-time fee. But when you compound that return, you know, year on year after year after year, it's a terrible bargain for them.
Yeah.
And just teaching people to think that way does not come easily.
So what I was kind of wondering about as I was reading this, and I'm hearkening back to a conversation you had with Agnes Callard, where you talked about philosophy and reading the ancient texts, right? And so there's a point she made, I think it might have been in an article that you referenced, not necessarily the conversation itself, but this idea is there, which is that we read the ancient philosophers because I'll use my word, infected our thinking, and it's the roots of quite a lot of current philosophical thought. They wouldn't have had a chance to think about compound growth and zero time preference, right? So it seems to me this is actually a philosophical innovation, the likes of which the world hasn't seen in millennia. Could that be the case? Big words.
Yes, you know, Agnes is one of the deeper understandings of ancient philosophy because she also has a PhD in ancient history and has studied ancient philosophy. And the view of many of the early Greeks was there's something retrogressive about history or cyclic. So you advance for a while and then you move backwards.
Yeah.
So it's hard to reap a lot of compound returns. It was probably correct for them to believe that in their time.
Yeah.
But we're now in a world where at least, say, Great Britain since, you know, the 1620s or so has mostly had positive compound returns for centuries.
Yeah.
And that's a practical innovation, and our theories need to adjust accordingly.
Yeah. Is it something that is this the beginning of that adjustment? I mean, had people talked about this before, or has this been unconsumed by the philosophical community for the most part?
If you look at the classical economists, Smith, Ricardo, John Stuart Mill, they're at least toying with the idea of compound returns.
Yeah.
They're still living in an age of relatively slow growth. It's not until fossil fuels that industrialization truly picks up. But as far as I know, those are the first glimmerings of it. And before the Industrial Revolution, the cyclical model, you do well for a time, but someone conquers you, or there's an environmental problem, and then things fall into decay. That was the rational and common view for much of human history.
There's another problem that the actually framing things in terms of economic growth being the ultimate goal. And I know you actually define it not just as economic. Maybe talk about this for a minute. It's not just economic growth, GDP growth. It's wealth plus. Maybe talk a bit about what wealth plus is.
Well, I talk about the notion of maximizing the rate of sustainable economic growth, but I don't think we can quite just use current GDP numbers. They're missing some important features. They're generally an overall decent guide, actually somewhat underrated, but they don't count leisure time. They don't in every way count the quality of the environment. So we need to tweak them a bit if we're going to use GDP numbers as our guide. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's so very hard to do, but I call it wealth plus instead of just taking GDP as measured for granted.
And what's an example of something that's in wealth plus but not in GDP?
For instance, if we are releasing too much carbon into the atmosphere, and maybe 30 years from now this will have a terrible consequence, but we don't see it quite now, we need to worry about that. Or a country that is growing at a higher numerical rate, but everyone's unhappy because all people do is work. Yeah. We need to count that leisure time.
Yeah. And the problem that this idea solves, or I mean, it solves a really nasty one, maybe a few interlinked problems, is something that you call the aggregation problem, which is, so let's say the alternative to call it a numerical aggregation. So numerical, this is a case of economic growth, something you can measure. And so now there's actually a value you're assigning to things because they have a number, and you add those numbers up and you get the total amount of economic growth which occurs. And the alternative to that is if you were to, say, talk about goals, and it's hard now to say, you know, my objective is to maximize peace, maximize happiness, whatever, and you have to define these things for one, then you have to determine trade-offs between them for another. Right. And how do you add them all up together? An aggregation problem is almost insoluble in that kind of philosophical world.
And my answer to the question, like, when can we say one choice is better than another? It's when the better choice gets you compound returns and the other doesn't. That's the one judgment you can make. If the time horizon is long enough, the compound returns will pay off for you.
Mm-hmm. So maybe it's worth talking a bit about what I think might be some downsides to that. I was struck again by your interview with Elizabeth Gelfand. And you were talking about tight and loose cultures.
Michelle Gelfand. Sorry.
When you were talking about that, you asked her whether there was a relationship between tight and loose cultures. Maybe we can define that for a second, if you're all right with that. And that it wasn't necessarily related to economic growth. And so tight cultures don't tend to do better or worse in terms of wealth or economic growth. And that seemed to be disappointing to you in a certain way. Am I right on that?
A tight culture, she defines, as one where the norms are fairly strong and people are fairly constrained. A loose culture is one where there's more sort of choice and tolerance and openness, but also maybe people will be free to make too many mistakes. She argues in her work there's no correlation with wealth. I'm not sure I agree with that judgment. It seems to me there are some cultures more conducive to producing wealth than others. Mm-hmm. Maybe they cannot be well described along the axes of tightness and looseness. But if you look at the well-off countries in the world today, they do have common features. The places, say, from East Asia that have become wealthy, Singapore, Japan, South Korea, have done so by importing or copying at least some particular practices from outside. So I think there are common norms behind prosperity.
So let's just sort of take the counterfactual then and say that there wasn't. How would you fit what it seems to be an important distinction between human experiences in different countries that doesn't map upon economic growth? Does that just fall into the pot of the, you know, the uncertainty, saying, well, these are just sort of things sort of boiling away in the world and they don't actually matter, actually, in the end? How do you fit the discussion of tight and loose cultures into your value system as it's, how would you in this book, or something else that doesn't necessarily affect economic growth, but it feels like it should matter, but it's not a right, and it's also not affecting growth. Is there another category, or these things actually just don't matter?
Partly I interviewed Michelle Gelfand because she has this other axis of culture, tight versus loose cultures, that I hadn't thought about enough. And I thought, well, I'll learn something by talking to her. So what I see is a critical norm, for instance, is at what age do women have children? And that if that's pushed off somewhat in time, you have a much better society. And it seems to me that's close to universal. Mm-hmm. So you look at a country like Niger, where really a very high percentage of women have children before 18, and the human capital transmitted from the mother to the children is low, and that tends to lead to bad political outcomes, a much lower standard of living. It's not on the loose versus tight axis necessarily. So it gets back to what are the cultural axes that explain the world best? And one of them is that.
It seems to me that, so I did an interview with Robin Hanson on this podcast, and one of the questions I asked him was what he thought was going on by, you know, he has this distinction between farmers and foragers, right?
Right.
So you know this better than me. So the more organized society, farmers, organized is the right way of putting it, but you have stronger norms, you have tight cultures. And then I think that's the right way of mapping that. And you have forager societies, which are much more loose, I guess. And, you know, he describes, and I feel like it made sense to me, of this progression of our own society, let's call it, you know, North American society, of going from tight to loosening over time. And I asked him what he thought was going on there, and he said, we're just getting richer. And so as we're getting richer, we're just behaving more like rich people have always behaved. And so it's more of a transition as opposed to a progression. Am I getting that right? What do you think about that?
That's a good description of what Robin thinks. I'm not convinced by it. I mean, everyone has their own set of cultural distinctions or the cultural axis that matters. In my view, we don't really know what forager societies were like. There's a few of them left in the world today. but we're watching highly corrupted versions of them
sure.
that also have had a lot of contact with agriculture and a small sample. And even then, they seem to be highly diverse. So pygmies, tribes found in the Amazon, tribes found in the Philippines. From what little I know about them, they don't seem to be all the same thing. The notion that values necessarily get looser as we become richer, it's mostly been true since World War II. I'm not convinced it's a general pattern. It's like people who think, well, liberalism is inevitable, tolerance is inevitable, we're all going to be secular. I would just say those are hypotheses. They've appeared mostly true for about 40 or 50 years. But if you just think we're going to play out the clock and keep on waltzing along that line, you're probably in for some huge surprises. And just we've seen like Brexit, Trump happen, to me suggests the standard view of you're sliding along these curves of ever greater liberalization is probably not right.
So they're cyclical?
I would say we don't know. Cyclical means, well, on average, you tend to move in the opposite direction. It may just be a random walk.
Mm-hmm.
It may depend on, say, technologies, which are not cyclical, but not just always moving in the same direction. The foragers, I don't know what hunter-gatherer societies really were like or are like now.
So what would your story be for the cultural, let's not call it progression, but transition over the last 50 years? I mean, you have things that appear to be, call it, you know, liberal changes over for society. I mean, think about gay marriage and think about various other kind of social constraints which existed 100 years ago, which don't really so much now. What is going on or was going on, maybe?
Maybe there are two stages to the pattern. The first would be earlier in the 20th century, where people go from living on farms and not graduating high school to basically car in every garage, chicken in every pot. That's bringing us up maybe through the 1960s. So you go from pretty poor to actually pretty well off.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, there's still economic growth, but a lot of life looks the same. Like this table, you know, we're at, the bottle of water. It's not that different from the 1960s, mm-hmm. other than the smartphone. And then there's stories like greater tolerance, most of all, elevation of women,
mm-hmm.
Social changes, changes in health, retirement is much more pleasant. People are less likely to beat their children. And the last 40 years, those seem to be maybe more important than just piling more prosperity on top of the heap.
Yep.
And what's coming next? We don't know. I feel we're at another breakpoint. It's making many people uncomfortable. They're flipping out.
Mm. Are those in Wealth Plus, those things?
Yes, those are in Wealth Plus.
Right.
So greater tolerance. If you're, you know, born gay today, your prospects are really much, much better than would have been the case in the 1970s.
Yeah.
In the United States, at least.
Yep. And does that result, this sort of the idea of being born gay, being better off in wealthier societies, does that hold statistically across the world?
Certainly for the Western world, it seems to me there might be some African countries where that's not the case.
Mm-hmm. The way richer they get, not the better it gets for the gay population.
I would say I'm uncertain, but it could be wealth is also greater surveillance in some ways. And if you have anti-gay norms in a society, you can have periods, maybe also in Jamaica, where greater wealth is going with inferior treatment of minorities, people who are gay, people who are different in other ways. It's not always all pointing in the positive direction.
Mm-hmm. And so, again, back to my original kind of thinking here is these are things which, in the strict reading of your value framework, matter then, in the sense that they are related to economic growth and they are part of Wealth Plus.
Absolutely. So if today you're born and you end up being gay, you will be probably more productive. There'll be less discrimination against you. You'll get a better job. You may have a better chance of founding a company. Like that counts in regular GDP. But just you're probably happier. You know, you have a greater chance of finding a partner or building the kind of life you want to have.
Mm-hmm.
And not all of that's in GDP, but it's very, very important.
Mm. Another thought that I was having, this is more kind of in your wheelhouse of the world of public intellectuals, here's the question. Should academics or people who seek to influence the world, and according to your value system, should they try and boost economic growth more? So I'm thinking of, on your podcast, you've had venture capitalists, right?
Right.
And I think of these in some ways as public intellectuals who are trying to boost economic growth.
And they think very conceptually, venture capitalists.
They do.
And they're generalists.
They are, right. Right. And are they similar to university professors? I mean,
they're much better, right?
Better at?
Almost everything. They're smarter than we are. They're playing with real stakes. They
yeah.
understand more different things. They're better at judging people. They've created more good for the world in most cases. So we should feel ashamed of ourselves if we sit down with venture capitalists.
And yet they don't win a Nobel Prize, right? And they can't become, call it, historically famous, or much less so. I mean, obviously,
I think they will become historically famous.
Do you? Okay.
Well, they already, so like a Mike Moritz or a Mark Andreessen or Sam Altman, Y Combinator, I think they will go down in history as major figures of great import.
Would there be an analog? So is it like a Rockefeller kind of thing? Or is there a higher level of status associated? They're achievable for them. So I'm thinking like, think between, let's say, a Rockefeller and Albert Einstein.
Right.
Similar levels of achievement. Einstein's way, way more revered and more famous, I think. But, you know, would in the future, would today's Einstein actually pale in comparison to Peter Thiel, let's say, or Marc Andreessen or one of these guys?
I don't know that we have an Einstein today. There's plenty of science, but particular contributions are more doled out into parts. There's mm-hmm. more division of labor. So maybe Craig Venter or someone would be something like that. But you don't even hear his name as much anymore.
No, you don't.
Which is odd. So someone like a Mark Zuckerberg, Peter Thiel, in relative terms, I think a lot of us are underestimating how much fame they will keep. They will be like symbols of an era, people behind Google.
But will they be able to point to something? Because I feel like you need a trinket. I think you need some kind of
the internet
status.
Is that trinket, and the internet may be replaced by something better, but it will still be seen as an extension of the internet.
Yeah.
And these will be like the Einsteins of the internet.
Is that too diffuse? Because I worry about their status. So I worry about the future status, future perception of the current status of a Peter Thiel, because I feel like, he had a great return on equity or whatever the percentage, some assessment of the economic contribution that he made. But those seem to be such dry statistics. It's not inspirational to people. I worry about that. Do you think I'm right on that? Or
I think there will be 10 to 15 people seen as essential behind the development of the internet. Peter Thiel and other venture capitalists and CEOs will be on that list.
Mm-hmm.
There's still time for others to displace them. But they were in there at the early stages, and people in at the early stages, say who wrote the first novels or the first symphonies, they tend to keep those positions, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think a distinguished, so let's call it, there's like in the Venn diagram of intellectual life, you have academics obviously explicitly dedicated to that. You have venture capitalists. The circle covers academics, but also covers some of this business, you may call it more prosaic kind of business thinking. How to manage people, which are important skills. I spend a lot of my day job thinking about those problems. I think they're hard problems, underappreciated problems.
Right.
There's another part of that Venn diagram, which doesn't really overlap as much with venture capitalists, and that's journalists. So the thing that surprises me a lot about journalists is actually how damn smart they are.
Of course.
I mean, remarkably so. And you know, they're also, I think, of as netherworld academics in a lot of ways. And there's a lot of overlap between what academics do and what journalists do. But it seems to me that venture capitalists are just eclipsing them as, call it, the couch potato, armchair academics, and they're not adding maybe as much value. And what I'm wondering about is, in your philosophical framework, do you think that journalists are overvalued because they're not necessarily contributing to economic growth?
I think journalists contribute a great deal to making politics better by enforcing accountability.
Hmm.
I can't think of individual journalists today who I think will remain famous for long periods of time. There's simply very many good ones, so it's journalism that's adding the value. But if you said, well, who's the Einstein of journalism, or even like the Peter Thiel, Mark Andreessen of journalism, Mark Zuckerberg of journalism, whatever you might think that to mean, it's much harder to come up with the names. You would just say, well, the whole ecosystem. And, you know, whatever happens with the Trump administration, I don't have a prediction at the moment, but it seems under all scenarios, journalism will have played a major role in the final outcome there. And that's significant.
Mm-hmm. So maybe tying it together with the book, you mentioned, it was interesting, actually, you said one of the ways in which you recommended we synthesize it is actually that we have undervalued East Asia.
Yes.
And to explain what that means, that's an interesting comment.
Well, I'm not sure that East Asians undervalue East Asia.
Fair enough.
But Americans, we're certainly all familiar with the fact a number of those countries have grown at a rapid pace. But to me, that they're of special moral importance. That's like the one case in world history where countries did everything possible to grow at as rapid a pace as possible and basically succeeded. So we should revere those experiences as a kind of central principle, a world historical principle that East Asia got right so far. And nowhere else has.
Do you know why? Why would they have gotten that right? Because I think of the kind of longer history of East Asia as being a little bit more depressing and cyclical. Think of China closing off, and Japan and those countries as actually being, you know, to reference another book of yours, incredibly complacent.
But at least recently, or relatively recently, they've grown at rates approaching 10%. For the most part, they have stayed quite stable or even become more stable.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, growth rates fall at some point. They had wise leadership. Often good policy, in many but not all cases, well-educated population. So if you look at Chinese education or even Chinese IQ while China was still poor. IQ and education were pretty decent. In a way, say that was not true for, you know, Western Europe in the year 1500 or 1600. Mm-hmm. So they had that head start. They understood how to build on it. Singapore probably has had the smartest economic policy maybe of any country ever. So those are impressive achievements. I'm glad there's this movie out now, you know, Crazy Rich Asians. There are objectionable features to the movie, don't get me wrong. But the mere fact there's something on the screen, Americans can look at the screen, see Singapore and say, oh my goodness, these people live in a much nicer place than we do, ought to be like a slap in the face and a wake-up call. And I'm delighted that it's out there for all its imperfections.
And the word you actually used when you described that was the Straussian reading of the book. And that, listen, I've been reading your blog, Tyler, for 10 years, and it was only a couple of years ago I figured out what Straussian means. Could you just define that for us quickly, and we'll talk about that again for a second.
Well, I often use the phrase, you know, Straussian reading, or I refer to Strauss, and the single question emailed to me the most often is, what does this mean?
Yeah.
But I think the point is there's not quite a single meaning. And if you Google what is Straussian,
I tried that a few times.
It doesn't necessarily help that much. And Leo Strauss himself was a deliberately obscure writer.
Yeah.
I think of Straussian thought as a method, not a single conclusion. That's why it's hard to define. You try to read things at ever deeper levels and pull out ever richer layers of meaning. And that's the Straussian method. Mm-hmm. It's useful for making you smarter and see different perspectives. There's the like much more specific view, the belief that older writers wrote in a form of code. They didn't always say up front what they thought. I agree with that. But when I say Straussian, I mean the broader approach to Straussianism.
Close reading, deep reading. There's hidden messages. Maybe it's deliberate, maybe it's not.
And always probing more and more. And yes. When you meet actual Straussians, ask them what Straussianism, you get all these different answers. But like the thing they embody is this passionate commitment to always trying to read, think at a deeper level. And that to me is very impressive.
So I have a Straussian reading of this book. And this Straussian reading is that actually...
I'm happy already, by the way.
Okay, good. It's actually a sequel to Average is Over. And I know it's not, but this is how I think of it. It's actually Average is Over. And I was re-listening to your podcast with Russ Roberts. And in that, he made the point, and you made... I forget who made it first, but you were agreeing about the fact that Average is Over, which I'd like you to just summarize that if you don't mind in a moment. I'll give it my shot, which is about how there's this... In society, there's going to be a big difference between people who are very good at the kind of development, the technology that society is producing, and then you have people who are not, and you're going to wind up with, you know, what Russ calls a bimodal distribution, which is you have, you know, a whole bunch of haves and a bunch of have-nots and a sort of hollowing out of the middle of society. And in that conversation, you were talking about how really the book was not, as you put it there, not normative in the sense that you weren't really venturing an opinion on it. You weren't saying this is good or bad. This is kind of just what's happening. And I think that the Straussian reading of stubborn attachments is that that's not true. It actually, this is a message to the have-nots from Average is Over and saying, just do it for your grandkids.
I agree with that. But I'll, was it, you know, see your bid and raise you a few.
Okay.
So I think there's a consistent Straussian reading of all my books starting in 1997 with In Praise of Commercial Culture. So In Praise of Commercial Culture, What Price Fame, my early books on culture, they're mostly positive and optimistic about commercialism, but they see some ways in which it's alienating, and they raise the question of whether commercialization, capitalism, create a sufficient mythology or religion to be self-sustaining. Hmm. So the optimistic books are, in fact, a bit pessimistic. And one thing Stubborn Attachments is trying to do is fill in the boxes of what that mythology has to look like. Mm. This extreme valuation of the future, attachment to compounding returns, sustainable economic growth. And I also understand that's not enough to inspire most people. So you need a kind of lower level, more religious version of that idea. And Stubborn Attachments, read between the lines, indicates that, and I think suggests it rather strongly. Mm-hmm. So I think, I don't know, like 15 books or so, however many I've written, they more or less all tie together with this consistent message, and each one has a kind of flip Straussian reading. The optimistic books are a bit more pessimistic than they look. The pessimistic books are more optimistic than they look, mm-hmm. and it's all part of this big, long story, mm-hmm. but I'm not allowed to say that anywhere else, only on your podcast. I'll never say it again.
Thank you very much. And so I'm going to switch to some more general topics, I guess, and one of the things that you've done for me, actually, is, and this is probably not, this is probably a Straussian reading of your own advice, which is to lower the status of books. So you read a lot of books.
I read a lot of books.
And you throw books away.
Correct. It's become a problem for me. I get so many review copies, not a complaint, by the way, if you're a publisher listening. But simply carrying them away from the house has become a logistics issue.
Yeah, right. They're heavy.
And I give a lot of them away. I don't throw them all away by any means. The good ones I give away. I'm very careful to give it to the right person.
Yeah.
But some of them I feel, well, if I give this to a person, they might read it, and they should be reading Moby Dick instead. So unless I think it's the very best book for someone in particular to read, I won't give it away.
Mm-hmm. And you don't even finish books, most of your books.
Correct. Yeah. I just read parts of them.
Yeah, as much as you feel like you want to. And
but a lot of books I reread. My favorite books, the most important books, I try to read 3-4 times in the course of my life.
Yeah. And you've mentioned many times that you reread Shakespeare frequently.
Yes.
And it's something that I've struggled with because I just don't understand. I can't get through the language. Like, any advice for me?
It's very hard. So I find, for instance, if I see a Shakespeare play on the stage, I literally cannot understand what they're saying.
Right.
If I read a vulgar edition with notes and follow the notes, I can do fine. But I'm a slow reader of Shakespeare, and to get the right edition for you, vulgar is one place to start.
Mm.
But without the notes, it's, you know, maybe not going to work. So and I worry that 50, 100 years from now, like, no one will be able to really read Shakespeare in the sense that hardly anyone can read the real Chaucer today.
What do you get from it then, if you can't really read it? Could you still get something from it? What do you get from it?
I can read Elizabethan English well enough with notes. I think Shakespeare is the deepest, most profound observer of human nature and the diverse condition of humanity, the nature of political power, the differences between the sexes, tragedy, comedy. Everything is in there in a way that's not the case for any other thinker humanity has produced. And maybe only 2/3 of them require study. You know, some of them are not necessarily that good. Merry Wives of Windsor, like, should you read it once? Probably. Should you study it? I mean, probably not. But something like the Henriette or King Lear or Hamlet or Measure for Measure, Midsummer Night's Dream, my goodness, you could, like, read these every year for the rest of your life and always discover more.
Is Tyrone kind of Shakespearean? I mean, what does he emphasize intellectually relative to you? Is it more about the kind of the darker side of the human condition? Is that an appropriate reading of Tyrone?
Think of Tyrone as one of the Shakespearean quote-unquote fools or buffoons,
right,
who very often speaks the truth and says things other people won't say or can't say or are afraid to say.
Mm-hmm.
So he's a particular kind of Shakespearean character.
I think sometimes of when I see somebody making a mistake or doing something that's wrong or appears to be wrong or probably is wrong, I often get it. Like, I know why you did that. And I feel like that because I've experienced similar urges in my life, which are the wrong thing, and you don't always do it. Sometimes you do. I've made mistakes, of course. But I feel like that there's I have an appreciation, maybe an overappreciation for that. And I sort of afford a little bit too much sympathy to people who make mistakes because I just kind of get it. And I understand how you could easily do that. But I for some reason, get the feeling that people, when they have those feelings, they forget about them for some reason. And they load up with negativity, opprobrium on people that make mistakes and so don't seem to me to understand failing in the right kind of way. Tyrone seems to me to be an indication that you do understand failings in people. And is it that you feel them yourself? Do you introspect about that? And you're like, I kind of get why somebody made those mistakes.
Sure. And I have a phrase, I call it devalue and dismiss.
Mm.
You can always look at what other people are doing, find the mistakes, and play a strategy of devalue and dismiss. Oh, this person said that, or they had this outrageous moral view, or, you know, they forecast that incorrectly. But you still want to learn from them. And it's often the people who offend you the most that, at least at the margin, you can learn the most from. I'm not even saying they're the wisest, but they're probably the people in the past you've learned less from because they offend you. And try to learn more from those people.
I want to switch to your podcast a little bit. I have a Straussian reading of your podcast.
Great.
I love your podcast.
Thank you.
And what's interesting to me is the variety of guests, right? Podcasts tend to be variety shows.
Sure.
But I think that your style is really interesting because you have obviously a broad range of interests. And I mean, in some ways I find that description of you to be a little silly because I feel like everybody has broad ranges of interests. You're just more public about them than other people are, maybe putting yourself out there a bit more. But you've interviewed Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Martina Navratilova, Dave Barry. And what amazes me about some of those interviews, in particular the Dave Barry one that struck me, is you're coming to it actually as an economist. And so the jargon you're using and the kind of questions you're asking, to me, the Straussian reading of your podcast, the incorrect Straussian reading, in my mind, is saying to to, I guess, the world, isn't it cool how economists are and how we can actually ask people these questions? And, you know, I'm a variety show, one-man variety show, and that's neat, and academic, raising the status of academics. But I actually think the real stressing reading is the message, the audience for Conversations with Tyler is academics, and saying, here's the things you should be interested in, and here's, I'm interpreting the rest of the world in a language that you can understand, and I don't care if they don't know what Straussian means. I mean, you haven't used that word, and you're being more kind than that, of course, but you're not actually sacrificing what I see it as your intellectual style, as a certain region you're from, and you're kind of interpreting the world explicitly as an academic economist, and showing everybody that it can be done.
Well, I think both of those are true. You called one the real Straussian reading.
Well, my own was Straussian.
That makes me a little nervous. They're both possible Straussian readings. And then the other Straussian reading is, I want to do these interviews so I can focus my own reading. And I learn more when I read, if I'm preparing for someone or something. So I'm not in any way paid to do it. And the notion that it improves the quality of my reading as what it's really about in a selfish way.
Yeah.
That's yet another quite significant, you could call it Straussian reading. I don't know if it's even that, but it's a big motive for me.
Do you listen to podcasts?
No, not at all.
Really? Interesting.
I find them too slow, often boring. I don't like how most people do interviews. There are too many questions. Oh, could you tell us what your book says?
Yeah, sure.
And then you get some kind of drone-like answer where I could read it like at 13x the speed. So even you do 1.5x on podcasts, why should I listen? I will listen if I'm about to interview a person as a kind of prep. But I never feel it's like what I want to be doing. What I want to be doing is reading.
Mm-hmm. I listen to a lot of podcasts. It's the reason I started this podcast. And I get a couple of things out of it. One, I can do it on, I call it podcast time, which is when I'm doing something else. I actually tend to listen to a podcast, cleaning the dishes or walking the dog, whatever I'm doing, commuting. A little bit less than I'm commuting because I feel like I have too much attention energy when I'm commuting. I'd rather be reading or writing or doing something else. But I found it to, I think podcasting is maybe the one of the most significant educational innovations, you know, since the printing press, because I think that
I agree
in this one particular way, because I think that what's great about conversations is that there's misunderstanding in a conversation and
right.
It can get worked out in real time. Whereas opposed, I think writing is a little bit too perfect. And in the sense that you can actually express an idea very efficiently in a written word, but it doesn't understood efficiently because you have to read it over and over again. Sometimes that would be a complex idea and you don't really necessarily, you don't have an audience to kind of react to what you're saying. And I think in podcasting and conversations, you have this interactive element to it. And listening, I think that Russ Roberts' podcast is one of the things that's taught me maybe more than anything else I've ever encountered in my life. Because it's two experts talking about something for the most part.
Right.
And they skip through all the intro crap because that's boring for the most part to them and to me. And they go right to the hard issues. And through the hard issues, you can actually get a feel for what the underlying principles are, and it doesn't do enough of them, you know. But hearing experts converse about a topic, I think is really, I think the best thing I want to do with my spare time when I'm trying to learn about a new topic.
I like reading transcripts of podcasts,
oh,
but here's the thing in my life. So I write every day, and in my downtime, things like driving, commute, I listen to music, which first of all I love, but I feel I need to keep my mind open for what I'm writing on. And the podcast fills me up too much.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't want to hear it in the car. I don't want to be trying to learn Spanish in the car or whatever else I might do. I want that to be a free open time, and music does that for me. And then I get more written.
Mm-hmm. I find that sometimes I can have some of my most interesting thoughts or when I'm listening to a podcast and my mind wanders a little bit into some other topic that it's almost a subconscious wandering. I actually stop the podcast and I'll just sort of think that thought for a little while and I might write something down, or it winds up being a kind of catalyst for other thoughts, which I like. There's one podcast episode, which is, I think, my favorite podcast episode, and I'm wondering whether you've heard of it. Ezra Klein and Sam Harris debate. Have you heard of that?
I've heard plenty of it, and I've had many people email me and ask me what I think of it. I haven't ever heard it. I've heard it was a kind of train wreck, though no one can quite agree, like, who was at fault or what went wrong.
Yeah.
But I certainly know what you're talking about.
So it's my favorite podcast episode of all time, and I agree with the assessment that can be considered a train wreck, but I think that the people who came out most disappointed in that were probably Ezra and Sam, because I think that they didn't resolve their tension, and their minds didn't meet. But it's almost as though that the product that they created was a phenomenal educational tool for everybody else. I think the rest of us really benefited from it, because I think it shows how two well-meaning, super smart, caring people who wanted to get there and figure something out couldn't do it. And to me, there's all sorts of Straussian readings, hidden messages, but also just sort of naked displays of the limits of some inquiry can be. And I re-listened to it again. I've listened to it twice. So I've listened to it three times.
Yeah.
And I like hearing, I don't like hearing it. I actually find it kind of uncomfortable, but I found it to be educational. And I think that, you know, it's almost, I think the Straussian reading of that debate is actually whether politics matters. So you think of, like, Sam's point is he's against the extreme criticism, the ostracization of public intellectuals for associating with Charles Murray's ideas. And Ezra, I think his point is, you know, there are certain topics which should be off limits, and because of the social destruction that they can wreak and empowering other people who will do bad things with those ideas. That's kind of my assessment of it. Ezra might not agree with that, or Sam. But really what it comes down to is I think, of whether, you know, if you're influencing a debate publicly in some way, do you have to consider that when you are writing something or when you're conducting research? I mean, it's not just about the objective question you're asking. There are things which are unrelated which should be taken into consideration. And I think Sam disagreed with that. I mean, what do you think about that? I mean, I know you haven't listened to it, but you've heard a lot about it. What do you think about that idea?
Maybe I deliberately choose not to listen to it, but I suppose I'd like a controlled experiment to rerun that podcast, but switch out, you know, one time Sam and one time Ezra with other people.
Mm.
And see what the result is and compare. And maybe we'd learn something more from that.
Yeah, that's interesting. Here's another pitch for podcasts. My favorite podcast is a podcast called Heavy Hands, which is about mixed martial arts.
Who runs it?
These two guys called Connor Rebush and, well, it used to be a guy named Patrick Wyman. Now it's a guy named Phil McKenzie. So it's independent. And what I don't even watch MMA. But what it's amazing about it is it's a technical analysis of the sport. And so it's two guys who are really smart guys just talking about something that I've learned by listening to the podcast and don't actually directly enjoy it myself. I have a history of doing this because I read Bill Simmons' blog for years, and you're right. A basketball fan.
Sure, I love Bill's stuff.
I don't even like basketball, but I loved reading his writing about
so
basketball.
So analytic.
Yeah, that's
and
right.
So informationally dense.
Yeah, and I don't really watch movies, but I loved reading Roger Ebert. When he wrote movie reviews, he was such a great writer of movies. I actually enjoyed the reviews and liked Bill's articles more than I enjoyed the actual product itself. And so it's a kind of consumption about it's a meta consumption of an actual product, which itself can be enjoyable, which to me is counterintuitive.
You know, one of the things we learn from podcasts, I think, is how often the audience doesn't mind when they're completely clueless about what's going on. So my podcast with Garry Kasparov, there's a part where he and I talk about chess quite intensely and rapidly.
Yeah, I loved it.
And a lot of people love that. They've written me, they've told me,
yes.
And they don't even play chess.
Nope.
But they feel something about the connection. And I think podcasts could go further in this direction of realizing, look, what the audience actually wants from the podcast isn't quite what the producers may think.
Yeah.
It's something more ineffable.
Yeah. I think of the quality as they're looking for people who are real. And I think that there's this, that's what charisma to me is. It's something you can be coherent and articulate and interesting at the same time as really actually speaking from the heart.
And my podcast with Callard has the same. Whether or not people know a lot about ancient philosophy or Plato, somehow that dialogue felt real to them, I think.
Yeah, it did. And it's a personal expression of your interest is your podcast. And there's overlap with some parts of your audience and not others. I mean, it amazes me when I talk to people about it. Everybody likes a different episode, listens to a different episode.
Yes.
It makes it very hard to track how many people are listening to this stupid thing.
And that it's not too professional. So the sound quality should be good. It shouldn't be obviously unprofessional, but at the same time, you don't want it packaged the way, say, a TV show would be.
Mm-hmm. So we're running out of time, but I wanted to touch on one other idea, which is your own audience. And you recently, you've been writing a New York Times column for many years, and you switched over to Bloomberg. You do write popular works, right?
Popular is a tricky word, but
yeah, okay.
Continue.
So I'm wondering kind of why you do that, what you're trying, you know, is there... Is it just because you find it fun to try and constrain yourself in a certain way to speak? Because your blog is not the popular voice of Tyler, right? I mean, you use more jargon. You speak about kind of more esoteric things. But I think that I definitely, when I flick through your links and read the Bloomberg columns, that's definitely for a popular audience, and it's edited, and it has a different feel to it. Why do you do it?
My Bloomberg editors don't, in general, you know, change my voice. They may improve certain things, but they don't try to make it sound not like Tyler. So what you read on Bloomberg is like the Tyler Bloomberg voice.
Yep.
And it's this idea of multiple perspectives that you should try to write some things through blog posts, other things through Bloomberg columns, New York Times columns, other things through tweets. and you'll understand it better. So writing for the Bloomberg audience, which is a fantastic audience, I meet people who read them all the time, is another way to learn things.
Mm-hmm.
It's also a job too, right?
Yeah, sure. That helps. So let's close on one last point, which is the proceeds of the book, Stubborn Attachments. You want to talk a bit about why you decided that? Because you did publish a version of this book a little while ago, and then now this is a proper publication, and something changed your mind. What was that?
I put it free online about 2 years ago, I think, and I just wanted people to read it. And then there was a new project called Stripe Press, which comes from the payments company, the tech company Stripe. And I thought this would be a great place to publish the book with a company that's actually doing things and trying to maximize GDP of the internet. It's part of the Stripe mission. I just thought that would be perfect. And the book is idiosyncratic enough, a mainstream New York publisher probably wouldn't even consider it. Mm-hmm. It's too philosophical. It's not like the normal length. It's shorter than average. So Stripe was interested. But I thought, this shouldn't be a book for me to profit from. And I was traveling in Ethiopia. I guess this was in June, and I met a guide in Lalibela, who I will call him Jonas. It's not his real name, to preserve his privacy. And I thought it would be neat to send all the proceeds of this book to him. One of the themes of the book is the wealthy countries being wealthy helps the poorer countries. So I believe people should actually try to live their work. And if they write something and mean it, they should incorporate that into their lives, be consistent. So I'm saying, the wealthy countries help the poor countries. I should do more of that. I argue in the book, people should be more altruistic at the margin. And I thought, here's my chance. Jonas's yearly income is really quite low. The proceeds of this book, in terms of him buying a house, taking care of the 10 people he is responsible for. He wants eventually to start a travel business in Lalibela. He struck me as a man of high integrity and intelligence, and he taught himself good English all on his own. Of all the people I met, I thought, he's the one I should give this money to.
My guest today is Tyler Cowan. Tyler,
thank you very much.
Thank you very much.